Hello and welcome to Channels, the Nextflow podcast. This is episode 34, going out on April 2024. My name is Phil Yules. I'm a senior product manager at Sakura, working with Nextflow, MultiQC, Wave, and the open source tools we develop at Sakura. And today I'm very excited to invite Jacob onto the podcast. Jacob, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's been great to plan this since we met last year at the summit in Barcelona. So I'm really excited for this episode.
Exactly. I was going to say that. It's been a long time coming. It seems like an age ago that we were stood chatting about this in the foyer, but we finally managed to pin a date down and get you on the show, which is great. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your background. You're one of a few people kind of, guess, using Nextflow not with genomics or so. I think it's really interesting to kind of hear a little bit about how you came to use Nextflow and how it's useful. But first, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, happy to. So I'm Jacob Zeitler, and I'm the head of R&D, I would say, at Matt Holland Studio. And at Matt Holland Studio, we're trying to bring machine learning to material science. And for my personal background, I'm finishing my PhD at UCL, so University College London. And so that was in machine learning, and then something called efficient experimentation, I would call it, also known as Bayesian optimization. And so during my PhD, I got to work with a company in the material science space, and they were building a really interesting material. They've been running experiments for 20, 30 years. They kind of were getting a little bit to the diminishing returns of the theory and intuition. So when you make a new material, kind of have to adjust the temperature in the oven, or chemical A and chemical B, what's the ratios and so forth. And you could go into a laboratory and just, play around a little bit. And that's also known as alchemy, I guess. But usually you want to go a little bit more structured in there. And yeah, there are established statistical methods, and there are newer machine learning methods such as Bayesian optimization.
What kind of materials are you talking about here? Is this kind of like plastics or ceramics? Or?
Yeah. It's actually any kind of material. So at the moment, we focus on the material space because there's kind of like a bit of momentum to bring these methods and the kind of, I don't want to say revolutionize, but like update and advance the way experiments are currently run. But we're talking anywhere from like solid state chemistry. So that's just like kind of powder stuff that has certain properties, to yeast cells. So right now we're starting experiments in Munich on yeast cells, where you feed them nitrogen and carbon just like a human. But with those yeast cells, you kind of want to create sustainable fuel. So kind of like bio-based synthetic stuff. There's also alloys, this very popular one. So in alloys, you also have to mix together different metals to create different kind of properties. So anywhere where you're experimenting, really, Bayesian optimization applies. That's all across the board, really. It's in a way really interesting to talk to so many different companies and see the parallels and differences to how materials are being developed. Anything goes, really. Yeah.
So, I mean, presumably this kind of field has been around for a long time. You know, people have been experimenting with new materials for as long as we've been around, I guess. Yeah. I mean, how big is this field? Like, I mean, are there lots of companies doing this? Is it, you know?
In terms of material science, I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but the last time I checked and talked with a person in the US, they have obviously the NSF unit, so that's the biggest research funding from the government. I think material science takes the majority of the funding, and that kind of makes sense, because materials kind of, I guess, run the world. Like everything around us is some kind of material, and so, you know, there are different incentives, I guess. You know, a big one, an increasing one right now, is sustainability, of course. So this, what I find interesting, this idea like that a lot of materials are over-engineered. So like they're actually too good. And because they're so good, they require a lot of energy to make, but we don't need them to be the good. Like imagine a chair made of titanium. Well, we don't do that, right? Because it's expensive and we don't need a chair to be so strong, right? So A lot of things can be toned down a little bit, but we often have maybe materials that have just been made really extremely good. But that's one area there. So like, how can we make materials that are more sustainable, switch out certain maybe even, you know, toxic or poisonous or bad materials with other ones while maintaining the performance? Sustainability one is one thing, then obviously high performance is another thing. I guess, you know, the defense sector, of course, also has huge investments in materials. So a lot of things, I think, come from the military and then into kind of civil usage. And, you know, all these like hyper fast jets and planes, and they can't be detected, you know, like this stuff is kind of like material design as well. And yeah, so it's an evolving space. I mean, you know, there was a recent story from MIT, where a lab was trying to create concrete that can store energy. And that's a really cool idea. But actually, the inspiration for their work is partially from the Romans, because the Romans were already creating really strong concrete and also something called self-healing concrete, where I think I might get this very wrong, but like cracks appear, but then water comes in, but that water then chemically reacts with what's in the concrete and it heals it up again. And that, you know, that's pretty sophisticated, but you know, that was the Romans back then already. So yeah, materials really have been around all the time.
Seriously good at concrete.
Yeah.
My wife's a structural engineer, so I spend a lot more time talking about concrete than your average person. So
she has probably a whole bunch of stories in that regard. Yeah. And concrete is actually also one of the big projects we're moving into actually right now. So we got funding from the UK government to develop these kind of machine learning methods for the concrete sector. And so this year we're spending the majority of our efforts on their project to make sure that we can bring these methods into developing new kinds of concrete. We're actually not alone there. Facebook/Meta had just published a project last year. Okay. In December, and we got to chat to the office there already. There's not like an extreme amount you can do, but like if you can do 10-20% on concrete production in terms of energy efficiency, you're making a huge global impact.
I was going to say that, because you talked about sustainability. I mean, concrete is a huge driver of CO2 emissions and things.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Sorry, I kind of dragged you off topic into interesting anecdotes about material science, but...
Yeah, no, this can go on forever, but... yeah, I mean, to sum up my background there, so we're building, you know, this platform, and we're building these algorithms and trying to bring really like the cutting edge Bayesian optimization into material science labs around the world.
So just draw that bridge between your PhD and what you're doing now. And then, so your PhD was on computational or mathematical methods then around this?
It was on machine learning probabilistic statistical data modeling methods. So bringing those into a lab, and that's maybe helpful to mention here, that there's obviously just the data-driven methods, and then there are the computational methods. So there's something called like molecular dynamics or DFT. These are physically inspired methods where you kind of simulate a nanosecond of a material behavior, and that gives you an idea of how good it behaves to a certain degree. So it will give you a number that correlates roughly with the real-world performance based on quantum physics or something like that. I did not do this. I don't have much knowledge about the intricacies of it, but in fact, actually it is quite relevant to the next flow pipelines, because what you can do, what people already are doing, is in fact, you know, they'll have a machine learning kind of model and that they merge with a physical inspired model. And so these could be just two next flow tasks, right? You define the inputs and then come the outputs, and that's how you define a pipeline. We're getting right into it, but this is how one of the usages there. So we'll have these computational tasks, for material science, where we want to schedule maybe a next experiment where we have to calculate it, and we can just go the data-driven way, or we can merge it with a physically inspired way. There's a really nice paper from 2022 where they were looking at high entropy alloys. And they had a data-driven part with machine learning, and then they had, I think, a DFT part with thermodynamics. And so they could have easily just used the Nextflow pipeline, but they didn't. So instead, they would have just a bunch of scripts flying around, I guess. Yeah, very much so. And so material science, in a sense, can learn still a lot from bioinformatics. Quite a bit behind. But, you know, I guess there's also a chance to leapfrog, because with NextFlow having been developed so long in bioinformatics, material science can actually just adopt that.
I think this is, I mean, obviously an interesting discussion that comes up every now and then. Like, NextFlow doesn't, it's been adopted by the bioinformatics community, but there's nothing about it which is intrinsically locked to that. It just is a workflow manager that works well with big files. So it's exciting to see it starting to get some adoption in other fields. So then tell us a little bit about Matterhorn Studio. Where did it come from? How does this fit in? What's the background of the company there?
Yeah, so the background is basically that through the PhD, I studied a lot of the Bayesian optimization methods. And, you know, at UCL, that PhD program is very theoretically focused. And I realized that we have a whole movement of material scientists that want to use these methods, but they don't necessarily have the training or the time to make the best use of them. So these methods, they can be used off the shelf, but they just wouldn't be that effective. So there would need to be some level of tailoring to the problem. Every machine learning model has, you know, a few knobs where you can tune it, some choices you can make where you can align it more with the problem space. And so the idea was really to bring the best kind of Bayesian optimization to material science, and make sure that we also, you know, kind of just raise the average level of Bayesian optimization use in material science. And so that company Matterhorn Studio is supposed to do that. So Matterhorn, it would be matter and horn, which is like the peak of materials. And so that's inspired from the first customer we have in Switzerland. And so with that company, we're driving that forward. There's a few other researchers in the world that are doing that in the academic setting. At the University of Buffalo, there's Christopher Rees or Marcus Noack, who have very concrete ideas, you know, of what needs to be improved right now in material science and how they use machine learning. And so we're basically trying to provide the tools to make that possible. And one of the tools is built on top of NextFlow secure platform. I was about to say tower, but just about safe there. So that is kind of like last year when I met Marcel, who had a conversation back then, who we just met at a lunch table at a conference, you know, completely irrelevant conference. It was his master's project. It was a completely different topic for me for my PhD, and I'm chatting to him, and he's telling me about, you know, this thing called NextFlow and how you can like execute pipelines and just define the inputs and outputs, and then it just works. And I'm just sitting there, and I'd been like for months been like looking for a solution how to do this in the smartest, bestest way. And he tells me like in less than 5 minutes how the whole thing works. So I come back from the conference like the first day and immediately get into like trying to understand how it works. And there's the machine learning example actually on the NextFlow page. And again, as you say, like NextFlow is not at all limited to bioinformatics. Like it's a very, unopinionated approach in a way. And so I just went straight in there, and I was like slightly, you know, distracted by all the bioinformatics stuff, but I saw the machine learning example and I was like, okay, let's just test it. Let's see how it goes. Nice. Marcel gave me a really impressive,
So I was going to say, we need more examples then. We need to kind of lean on you and others in
different fields
to come up with some different spread.
We are working on that, so that there's more to come in that regard. So I went through the machine learning example and I was like, this seems straightforward. And then even more so, I realized that the platform is particularly useful for us. The way we use it technically there is that the platform has obviously the API access. And I just define, you know, my AWS environment, define a workflow. And then so on our software side, you know, Matterhorn Studio, users have the data and then they can choose an algorithm, but actually every algorithm is just a NextFlow pipeline. And when they press run, it triggers a run on the tower. And then it triggers a run on the platform. And that platform will trigger it obviously on the AWS. On the AWS, we'll have our machine learning code that will pull from our API the data, do the calculations, you know, gives us all the monitoring. And then when once it's finished, it will push the data back on our platform, you know, the new recommended experiments, that is. And then give us all the meta data on the calculations of the experiments and how the machine learning went. And we can split that obviously up in different tasks. So there could be a data cleaning task that, you know, triggers some Python stuff. And obviously that can be combined with all kinds of other molecular dynamics calculations. And then, you know, once it's finished, platform just informs us if the API is finished and we can present that clean to the user. So the user never has to fully engage, you know, with the next flow thing, but they can. Because every opt app, we call them optimization apps, they can just go to the GitHub repo and just check it out and clone it, right? And so that's the great thing of that is that if we want to, you know, up the level of Bayesian optimization, it needs to be obviously transparent. And what's more transparent than a GitHub repo that you can clone and fork and make adjustments to? That's kind of like the very deep technical part of MetaHuman Studio.
Yeah. So, I mean, tell us a bit more about this kind of approach to open source. So, I mean, MetaHuman Studio, you're a commercial company, presumably. But so who's writing their workflows? Are they kind of community generated workflows or are you yourselves writing these or how does that work?
Yeah, so it's a mix. So at the moment, it's actually still just MetaHuman Studio that's pushing effectively these opt apps. So there's a whole bunch of algorithms out there and some build on top of each other and others are completely new, others are outdated, but some people are very opinionated and they want to have, you know, their own kind of algorithms and others are just like, do it for me. And so we are at the moment still building up, you know, a nice kind of like base level of algorithms that, that people can use. Facebook /Meta is developing by far the best Bayesian optimization framework right now. And so we're trying to bring that onto the platform with all the customizations it has. And that's obviously our developing part. But by definition of the opt store, we call it an opt store, but everything's free, is that any pipeline can be just, you know, forked and cloned and then submitted to the opt store and then made available to run there.
Can bring their own pipelines as well.
Exactly. For that's exactly the idea. And people, more importantly, can also take the pipeline off the platform. You know, if they're like, I don't want to run this on the cloud, I want to run it on premise. You know, like no one's stopping you there. We're hoping to provide the best kind of pipeline running and development environment. But if for whatever reason you don't need that, well, with the Nextflow standard, you are not limited at all, right? You could just take the code and go, and that's perfectly fine.
Coming back to one of the things you touched on earlier as well, I mean, I want to point out as one of the things I really kind of love about Sekiro Platform is it's entirely API driven. So everything you see through when you're clicking around is being driven by an API, and that we have an open API spec, so you can just sort of see all the endpoints. I was messing around with it the other day. We've got this kind of side project, SRA Explorer, and sort of it's my first proper effort to try and build something into it. But It sounds like you and I know many other people are kind of building, using Sekiro Platform as a kind of building brick underneath something in an invisible way. I mean, what led you to that? Like, how's that experience been for you?
How's the experience been? Exciting. I still remember the first time I got the whole workflow working, you know. You first, obviously, you get started with Nextflow and you run it on the command line, right? And then you're like, okay, now I can use that graphical user interface to, you know, click some buttons and run some workflows and put it together. And then you find the API and you look through it and you're like, okay, so I can do all of this by API. And then you have your own product, you know, in my case, like Bayesian optimization pipelines for materials. And it's very specific, right? And I'm like, well, I don't want the user... The user is never going to learn all about Nextflow, right, in the first instance, in the beginning. So how do I make it most easiest for them? Well, if they press a button start and I just do all the API handling, that's pretty cool. So once I had ready and I could click start and it just takes the pipeline and puts it on the server and it runs and it pushes stuff, it was great. So it was a great kind of like achievement in that regard. And the API was, you know, because of the open API spec, self-explanatory. I don't think I had to consult the community once, to be honest. It was maybe I had one. Say again.
That's a win.
Yeah, I think I played around with once. I think I confused one of the namespaces once. I think workflow and task or something like that. But you just build up to it. And it probably was harder to set up like the right AWS credentials than the API, to be honest. So the challenges were not with the actual API. But I know that obviously for myself, I'm a very like... kind of like, how do you say that, like cowboy programmer. So I just like jump in and like just throw requests and see what happens and get a feeling for it. You know, like it works just like that. So as documentation gets added to that, it will get even easier to get started.
So I know there are a lot of plans to improve the documentation in this year. So hopefully that will get easier, but it's still fun to hear about your experiences.
And it was great to see like the platform being updated like while I was working on it, so I would see like new features appear while I was developing and integrating the API. So it wasn't just like a stale kind of like platform where you're like, is this API broken or not, or is it just me, or is it them? Like, it was clearly, if things didn't work, it was most likely myself, because I could see that, you know, things were being actively developed. So
that's cool. And when you talk about AWS, so you have your own Matterhorn AWS account, and all of your kind of customers run on that account, and you charge them indirectly, I guess. Is that kind of rough?
Yeah, more or less. So at the moment, we don't actually even charge. The costs are actually too small because, again, like we're not bioinformatics. We don't necessarily have huge runtimes. So like the runtime of a Bayesian optimization pipeline is negligible, but yeah.
Okay. Well, you've led me very nicely onto one of the next topics, which I'm kind of curious about how the characteristics of these pipelines kind of look and how maybe they're differ to people in the community, what people are used to. I mean, when we talk about some kind of DNA sequencing pipeline, it often takes hours, if not even days, to run. We're talking about kind of hundreds of gigabytes of data in and out. It sounds like your workflows are maybe kind of different. Talk us through kind of how that looks.
Yeah, so it's definitely different. And at times you could, you know, talk of an abuse of how we use Nextflow. but the fact is, like, you know, if we use it and it works, like, there must be something to it, right? So definitely, like, we don't at the moment have huge, you know, data coming in. But that doesn't necessarily, you know, the reason why using the Nextflow pipelines is so attractive is because of the structure it brings. You know, it's not necessarily like the throughput it allows and the definition of the inputs and outputs. That's good to like force people to be structured. And so the thing is, though, going ahead, right, once people, you know, would use Nextflow pipelines, it would be much better for them to be structured. And then when they add, for example, molecular dynamics to it, which can take also days to run, you know, it's already available, it's ready and too good to go there. And so establishing a standard is hard work over many years, but you got to start at some point. And so we think that with these smaller calculations with machine learning, machine learning itself can also be long at times, but the machine learning we do is definitely not the long kind of running machine learning. We can make sure that foundations are set for people to use those pipelines in the long, you know, in the right structured way. Yeah. Say again, sorry.
Sorry, just saying, like, kind of room to grow and scale in the future.
Yeah, you know, we're all just doing computation, right? So surely there's something about how bioinformaticians have been mixing scripts and trying to make it structured over the last 10 years. That also applies to material science, right? So the way this, you know, the pipelines are structured in a general way is of course going to translate to computational tasks in material science.
How about the number of tasks? Because I've heard about some people who have got, you know, short running tasks of a few seconds, but maybe they have 10 million of them and they want to run them all in power. Is that the kind of thing you're working on as well, or is that not an issue?
Yeah, so we have just single task pipelines. But for example, we have this one customer, and it was kind of my test of like how, you know, easy is Nextflow to use. And I just like, we had this code running already locally. And then I was like, well, you know, Daniel, who works in the customer project, I was like, can you turn this into a Nextflow pipeline? And so he sat down and I didn't say anything. And like a couple hours later, he comes back and he actually was using the tasks, you know, inputs and outputs. So I was like, well, you could have done this just all into like one script and one task, but he actually wanted to, you know, define the, you know, the data cleaning step and the calculation step and so forth separately. So he just picked it up naturally and just implemented it there. And now we have some granularity over the task, you know, what's maybe going wrong and some monitoring. And yeah, so like that kind of developed naturally there. And so the longest running task is the final task of the calculation. We're still speaking of less like a minute. It depends how we do it. So in machine learning, you can go, you know, as crazy as you want, but, you know, there's a trade-off. So like at the moment we've set it to like a fast calculation, but this could also take, you know, more than an hour if we wanted to. And then we can just spin it up and we can just be, you know, there's low risk for us to monitor it because platform is monitoring it. AWS batch is monitoring. And we'll have great introspection of when it goes wrong. So we literally pull the log files automatically on failure from platform and just display it on our platform so we can see it straight away.
Very cool. And are you using CPUs here or GPUs or anything else more exotic?
Yeah, so at the moment we're just focusing on the CPUs. So, you know, we need to focus in many ways. In theory, we could use GPUs. We haven't looked into that. So Bowtorch, which is this, you know, very established framework for Bayesian optimization from Facebook, and it's built on PyTorch, and PyTorch has GPU acceleration. And in theory, you could enable that, you know, with some fiddling and plumbing. It just hasn't
been. Your tasks are only a few seconds long, when I guess there's not really much benefit optimizing at this point.
There's a few scenarios in the future where this might become quite relevant. So we might be looking into running benchmarks online on Amazon. And so to support that feature, so benchmarks effectively is like taking a test function and stress testing your algorithm, how well it's working on a synthetic problem. And so there you're not running the algorithm one time, you know, to get one recommendation, but you're running it 100 times. And so obviously suddenly 10 times, you know, 10 seconds, 100 times 10 seconds turns into a lot of runtime. So with GPUs, in theory, you could maybe accelerate that quite significantly.
I was going to ask that about within your workflows as well, whether you kind of have, we've talked about benchmarking in NF Core as well, and kind of parameter optimization and things like this, kind of having recursion steps within the workflow to try and find the sweet spot. Is that something you looked at, or is that kind of a bit off topic?
We haven't looked at that yet. But that is a good idea. So the benchmarking we do for now is still very much local. You know, you're looking at a Jupyter notebook maybe, or some Python code, and then you just maybe put it on a more high performing machine, and then you get the outputs. It's very manual at the moment. But as we try to bring maybe benchmarking onto Matterhorn Studio long term, certainly kind of like utilizing these kind of recursive task definitions could become quite attractive, yeah.
Nice. So, of course, I'm a bit biased with my background and everything with NF Core, and I think I watched your summit talk again the other day just to refresh my memory, and I think you got a question at the end of your talk about this as well. I mean, you're effectively kind of building community pipelines by the sound of it, or you'd like to with your open source.
Yeah.
How do you kind of see that kind of community involvement? Is it something that you could see us collaborating on in the future, or is it live better by itself? Or?
It's undetermined in the moment, as frankly, like the material science, you know, the machine learning community is still quite small and developing, and so I don't know where people will go, but presumably I can very much envision a world where we, you know, have a community where we can share knowledge between the bioinformaticians and material scientists, I don't know where the limits are of transferring knowledge there. But I think the first step we need is first to the material scientists to start to appreciate the benefit of pipelines. So for us, it's been pretty clear and easy, because with platform, we get so much, you know, headaches and risks taken away. So this is a no-brainer. But that's not true for, you know, certain academic settings. You know, we first need to kickstart the kind of like community just to appreciate pipelines. And then we can also bring them to, like, you know, maybe closer to bioinformatics. It might just naturally happen. So I would hope that, you know, when people see how we use Nextflow, that they'll get interested to check out the Nextflow community, check out the, you know, the forums on the bioinformatics stuff, and then realize, you know, what they can learn and take away from that. But I think we're still quite a bit far away from that, just because even like thinking about pipelines isn't a paradigm that's established yet. There are a few people, especially in molecular dynamics, I think that would get it first. And so they're playing around with tools other than Nextflow as well. I think like it's something called SnakeMake or something like that. So I've seen a few use that, the whole community still needs to come around. That's really it. So I can't make a prediction here, really.
You preempted my next question, which was if you'd had any kind of dipped your toes into any other workflow managers. SnakeMake is another one, obviously, from bioinformatics community. There's also kind of other ones which maybe come from other domains, like Apache Airflow, or there are many others. Did you kind of look at any of these other tools and kind of compare, or?
I did. It was a, you know, like as a small company that's, you know, making decisions about where to put a very limited time and resources, I did look at, you know, the differences. And to one degree, of course, I'm biased in the sense that when you get to talk to a Nextflow person in person, you're like building very quick trust, and you're like, I can actually ask this person questions all day and they're not going to hate me. So in one degree, I was like, I'm definitely going to use Nextflow because, you know, the access to like debugging is very fast. And it wasn't actually at the end, you know, Marcel or anyone that I initially met from Nextflow that helped me, but it was the Slack forum. So I went into when the Slack, the Slack channel for Nextflow. And so I had a bunch of questions on runtime for AWS Batch, and I just threw in the questions there, and people were so, I'm not trying to like promote and make this look nice, but genuinely people answered so fast and were super helpful and also funny. And so that kind of ultimately won me over, is that, you know, especially if you have, you know, any kind of experience like working with frameworks and stuff like that, the number one thing, the number one key indicator of whether you should invest your time or not is the community and the documentation. And so once I saw that, like, the, you know, that channel was hyperactive and like, you know, turnaround time of minutes, I was like, okay, this makes sense. You know, I'm not going to bother like looking into these other possibly stale looking solutions when I know that I have always people here that I can ask questions. So I did look at them and compare them, and it came down to community. It always comes down to community for myself. You know, I've spent a lot of time developing Ruby on Rails and Django and iOS and stuff like that. And iOS, of course, with Apple, you get great documentation. With Django and Ruby on Rails, you also get great documentation. But the reason, for example, why in the last years I've switched more and more to Django over Ruby on Rails is because just the community in Django is so much wider because it's built on Python. So you can load just so many Python packages at any point in time. It saves you so much time. And so the same way, from my first estimation when I was comparing, you know, solutions and community, I felt like Nextflow was most active and therefore, you know, most useful in the future for me when problems appear, because they always do. So finding a solution for that seemed the easiest to do in Nextflow. Again, might be biased because I already like kind of like knew how to join the Slack channels and stuff like that. But of course, no one else is prevented from joining those or going on the forum. And so I guess that's what I would recommend, is like compare the communities, how active they are, and how close the access is to people that know how to fix things. And for me, that was clearly Nextflow in that regard. I don't have much information on the technical comparison, which I also looked into, got a few opinions. But at that point, I had already been like halfway into like learning about Nextflow, running the examples and stuff like that. Didn't encounter any big
stuff
problems.
Was already working.
Yeah, stuff was working. I you know why? If it ain't broke, you know, don't fix it.
I mean, I think I hear similar kind of stories from people a lot. You know, that there's not necessarily parity, but there's a lot of overlap between the kind of capabilities of these different tools, and so things like community are really key. And I think, I mean, I've told the story before about, it was the same when I started using Nextflow years ago, and the community was only a handful of people. But even back then, we didn't use Slack, we used Gitter. But, you know, Paolo, the main author of Nextflow, would always reply seemingly any time of night or day.
It makes a huge difference. And we're hoping to provide, you know, the kind of same level of like, you know, support a community for the material science. And that's developing right now as well. So we have, for example, a hackathon. I mean, hackathons are huge momentum pushes, right? But in 2 weeks' time, at the end of March, there will be a hackathon for Bayesian optimization. I think we're going to maybe get around 100 people together. So this is a joint effort with Merck, funny enough. The Acceleration Consortium. And it's a testing ground for us to see how people react to pipelines. Already now, before the hackathon started, seeing people ask questions like, how are we going to supposed to, you know, what's the best way to share my algorithm? And like, I'm like, oh my God, you know, like I comment under there and I'm like, well, you could use like a pipeline structure. How about that? You know, take a look at this. And so right now I'm like trying to see, you know, how people react to this idea. It's a genuine problem. You know, you have every month now it seems someone's publishing an algorithm. It's a Python, you know, it's a Python code repository in GitHub, maybe not cleaned up nicely. You download it, the packages you don't match, maybe, you know, all the headaches, right? If this thing was a pipeline, you could literally run it with, you know, a single line on your command line. You could do it if it was a pipeline, if people adopted the standard.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned Python there, like that's one thing that comes up when you ask people kind of what things slow people down in their adoption of Nextflow. And, you know, Groovy comes up a lot, the fact that Nextflow is this DSL built into Groovy. Presumably most of the stuff that you're putting into your pipelines is Python. And I had a podcast episode the other day with Josh. We were kind of talking about how they use kind of Python scripts within their processes and how they pass metadata around. And have you found that kind of to be an issue, or is it just, it's not really been a problem?
Honestly, no problem. it just works. Again, not trying to sell how easy it was, but like, I mean, the machine learning example on the Nextflow page at the, you know, just go on Nextflow page and find the examples for the machine. It works, you know, like it is just Python, that's executed in a container. There's no magic to it in that regard. It's just like, it's just much better structured. And there was no issue as such. I mean, the issues was more on our side, maybe like not choosing, you know, packages consistently, something like that. We did have to do one hack. That's maybe because we don't know how to properly use the file system access. And again, that's why I'm saying like sometimes we might be more abusing than using Nextflow. So I think we've broken one design paradigm, which was how to access files, because we just kind of wanted to like access our own files. And in theory, you should be loading that in the proper Nextflow way. But we kind of just like wanted it directly there. So we've kind of like, you know, did some working directory access shenanigans to load some files that were somewhere else in the directory. But apart from that, you know, you just define your task, input, output. You say, you know, Python, run the script with some options. And it works. I mean, we have, you know, fancy stuff going on. We're passing parameters. Inside the Python script, we have, an API package that is using those parameters to access, you know, databases and other you know, IP zones, like, you know, it could be breaking in many parts, but it doesn't, as long as you define, you know, your Docker container or your packages in the right way. And in fact, we locally, I sometimes develop with a Conda environment, and then on production, we run a Docker container. And as long as those things are consistent, by definition, it doesn't break. And that's actually very, very important to us, because for the transparency of developing these machine learning algorithms, we also obviously need to make sure that the packages are consistent throughout. So that's actually a huge, huge feature for us, that is clearly defined and people are forced, you know, to define it.
Yeah, that's nice. Exactly. When you can pin exact versions, and you know that everyone running this version of the pipeline is running the same version of the software.
Absolutely. Hugely important. Yeah.
And have you come across kind of any other people in the Nextwave space developing similar pipelines, or are you kind of a number one pioneer?
I haven't come across anyone yet. You know, if someone's out there, please get in touch, hoping to learn from each other. But we're really excited to see where this goes. You know, it does feel pioneering in some way. The indicator we come back to is that it works for us, right? It just works for us. I don't know why I should change it. You know, other people might come by and they're like, you could use this solution, you know, you could simplify this. But I'm like, no, I want structured pipelines. I want a platform to help me manage AWS batch. You know, I want to be able to create different tasks. And I want the Docker containers to be clearly defined and so forth. So at the moment, I don't see any reason to do it much differently in the foreseeable future.
Nice. So tell us a bit more. So Matterhorn is how big is the company, and kind of where are you now, and what's your trajectory in terms of kind of projects and scope? And
we're based in Oxford here. You know, I've been around for 2 years. I guess every year is bigger than the one before. So with the grant right now, we're hiring two more full-time developers, which is going to be just really exciting. Hoping to just develop further the platform. These two developers will be working on the Nextflow parts of it. We have to do a database upgrade. And then once that, you know, we need to switch from one database to another one. Once that's done, I'm gonna, you know, send off one developer to like go crazy on the API and squeeze as much monitoring information out of the platform as possible. And then just to kind of like streamline and clarify how opt apps can be developed. We hope to, you know, continue to work with more and more laboratories around the world and see how Bayesian optimization can be brought to them. So the thing that we provide really, the value proposition there is that, you know, we can build an algorithm for your laboratory that's customized and works, you know, the best with your kind of material. And then you can run it 24/7 without asking us, right? Because you go on the Matterhorn Studio platform, you log in, you have your data, you have access to all your algorithms, including the one that we built for you. And then you press start and it triggers the run. And you never have to call us again. You don't have to email us. You know, it just works to do that calculation. And so this is where Nextflow comes in handy, because, you know, it just takes away all the risk of like how to implement this and things breaking, because all I do is send a Git URL, you know, with some maybe secret private keys to platform, and it will do the calculation, and inside that calculation, it will send back results to our API, and that's it. You know, I will never have to worry about AWS again.
That's the hope.
In theory.
Nice. And then I kind of realized we probably should have covered more of this in the introduction, is kind of how Bayes and optimization works and everything. Maybe a bit late in the podcast now, but I would say to anyone listening, do check out Jacob's your talk at the Nextwave Summit, because I've watched it a couple of times now. I think I get a bit scared when people mention words like Bayesian to me. But I think you broke it down really nicely. Can you give us kind of like an elevator pitch over why people want to run these things? And I mean, we talked about optimizing kind of experiments a little bit, but how is Bayesian optimization different to other methods, and why is it that people are so
happy
excited
to
about it?
So absolutely, you're right. A good reference is just to check out that summit video from 2023. That should be on YouTube on the Nextflow channels. But the rundown here in the podcast is that in the laboratory, let's say you're developing a material, you put it in the oven, you can choose, you know, the right temperature. So maybe, you know, it's much more harder if you put it in the oven for 100 degrees compared to 200 degrees, because 200 degrees is too hot, it dries out, it gets brittle and it breaks, and 100 degrees is the optimum one. To find that optimum parameter choice, there are different ways. Number one is you just randomly try it. You know, it's not stupid as such. It can work out quite well. The number two is that you kind of like create a grid. So you say, I take 100, 0 to 200 degrees, and I take steps of 20. So I do at 0, at 20, at 40, at 60. And that way you also learn kind of the behavior of the material. And then there's the more established classical methods, something called design of experiments. And that's where you kind of pre-calculate a grid to learn about the interaction of variables. So of course, every material doesn't just, you know, get influenced by temperature, but it's also a chemical A, chemical B, a certain kind of shaking factor, or how long is this in the oven, and so forth. and so all these different parameters will have interactions. So maybe 100 degrees is optimal, but then when you introduce a certain chemical, it might actually go up to 120 degrees. So we need to capture scientifically the interactions between different parameters. And so classical design of experiments can help with that. But when we get to more high dimensional spaces, like 20 or 30 dimensions, we can also use methods like Bayesian optimization. And so Bayesian optimization is about learning a model, a kind of like prediction machine of the behavior, and using the uncertainty around these predictions to make a recommendation what experiment to run next. And so, for example, we might one time around want to explore. So we're going to take areas with high uncertainty. So we can ask the model, where do we not know much? And then it will tell us, well, here I have really no clue. And then you go and run an experiment in these uncertain regions. And then once you collect the data points, you update the model, and suddenly these regions aren't uncertain anymore. They're actually very certain, you know, because now you have the empirical data. And then on the other mode, you can say, I want to exploit. So you can ask it, what are the best points right now? And it might be like, here are 3 points in the model where, you know, the material has particularly good performance. It's very, very strong when you use 100 degrees Celsius and 250 degrees Celsius. And then you can be like, okay, let's explore these kind of peaks a little bit more. And so it will go to these, certain predictions of peaks, and then try to, modify the parameters a little bit and, you know, find a peak that's even higher around these areas. And so it's a trade-off between exploration and exploitation, is classical machine learning paradigm anyway. And so Bayesian optimization helps to do that in a high dimensional space. So we can look at graphs, you know, we can easily understand data in 1, 2, and 3 dimensions. But once you get to 4, 5, and 6, maybe with DOE, you can get an idea, but 7, 8, 9, 10, 20, 30, good luck visualizing that. So with Bayesian optimization, you can, you know, statistically efficiently navigate this high dimensional space. And so this is something we haven't discussed yet so far, but this becomes particularly attractive in a new kind of idea that's evolving particularly fast right now, which is called self-driving labs or materials acceleration platforms. So if you can take your materials, you know, experimentation setup, and you automate it, and you close the loop by having, you know, the experiment done, it then is measured, and then you get the data points, then you can make a decision to run the next experiment. But if your robot finishes at night, it's not going to call you and ask you what to do next. Instead, it can just query, you know, for example, of Matterhorn Studio and the API access for the next Bayesian optimization inspired experiments and continue running, and, you know, do that 24/7 on the weekends, at night, and so forth. And so that way you can increase the data throughput, because the machine learning works better with more data. And you can possibly find new materials we haven't found before, because we didn't have the throughput And we couldn't close the loop because, you know, with DOE, you pre-calculate and you can do it in some sequential way, but with Bayesian optimization, you can do, you know, a closed loop sequential optimization by design. And so that's something people maybe want to look at. So that's heavy investments going on. We've got 100 million from the Dutch government, I think 200 from Canada. America is ramping up. The UK has also put down quite a few millions in this closed loop optimization. And those closed loop optimizations, either we're going to build them with some random scripts flying around, or we're going to put it into a pipeline, you know, that's structured and that we can share across the labs that are running these self-driving lab setups. Exactly. And so that's the ultimate goal here, really, is to use these pipelines to make sure that we have the best Bayesian optimization across all of these self-driving labs. Yeah.
We're not reinventing the wheel.
Exactly, yeah. Which is literally happening right now, the reinventing of the wheel. So we're trying to prevent that, yeah.
So if you don't have a closed loop system, it's kind of I'm trying to visualize a little bit how practically, you know, this is all used by someone in the lab. So someone would kind of run an experiment by hand, get the results, update the files locally, and then just kind of drop that into Matterhorn Studio, run the Nextflow pipeline.
Yeah,
which would tell them what to do next. They'd run it, and then they'd run the Nextflow pipeline. So they're kind of manually rerunning the same Nextflow pipeline again and again each time they've finished an experiment.
That's correct. Yeah, so that's literally happening. So our first customer in Switzerland, for example, we've set them up with that system. They right now can log in at any point in time, press the start button on their, you know, custom opt app we built for them, which is the Nextflow pipeline. It triggers it, pulls it, you know, with the secret API key onto the AWS badge, runs the calculation, you know, pushes the results back onto our database, and they see it there after 10 minutes. And we can actually speed that up. So there are some ways to bring this down to like 30 seconds if we really want to. So that's really snappy and really fast. But that's happening right now already. So they can query that at any point in time. They effectively are Nextflow users, you know, by the way this has been designed. And they can benefit from that. And any point in time we make a change to the pipeline, push that to the GitHub, they already have it on the fingerprints, right? They did at the tip of their fingers. They can just do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool. And that's what the API on the platform enables, is that we can trigger those runs for them even when we're not around. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. No, I see that a lot. It's kind of the benefit of using hosted services, I guess, isn't it? Kind of software as a
service. Absolutely, yeah.
Amazing. So anything you want to leave us with, kind of, you know, what can we expect to see coming out of your group and your company in the kind of next couple of years?
I think
on the horizon.
Yeah, so we're really pushing ahead hard with the pipelines. Like, this could be done in a simpler way, for sure. Like, we could just, you know, somehow set up an AWS batch and somehow just run some Python code. And, this has been proposed and discussed. But I do think that, like, piggybacking on you know, a decade of bioinformatics and a pipeline system like Nextflow has just much more benefits. You know, you're not custom brewing something, but, like, you can take advantage of so many features that are available in the Nextflow standard and integrate that even with the use of the platform, of the secure platform. And so I'm just really excited to see how this develops, you know, how we can utilize more and more features and make things faster. I mean, I'm still wanting to press that optimize cost button in the platform. in fact, it was also through the community that I was able to do some speed ups. I forgot the name of one of the key Nextflow developers, but he made a funny joke about how, you know, a PhD in bioinformatics is nice, but what really matters is like a PhD in AWS costology. So, like, figuring out these costs is just really important long term, of course. And so on the technical side, I'm just really excited to see how we can, like, get people thinking about pipelines and material science. And maybe it's overkill. There's a chance that it's overkill, especially if we move into the paradigm of like merging molecular dynamics, which do take also days, you know, to run with these kind of pipelines, then I think we actually getting quite a bit of a head start here with using Nextflow. And then on the strategic, yeah, sorry, go
ahead. I was going to say something I meant to sort of discuss earlier, I forgot it, was about kind of a modularity of these pipelines. And it seems like you were talking about breaking up the different tasks, so having kind of a data cleaning step. And I was kind of thinking about whether some of those steps would be shared across different ML pipelines that you've got, you know, where if a data cleaning is always the same, and how that could overlap with kind of a modularity system we have within NF Core. And, you know, you can then kind of start to collaborate and community drive these kind of Lego bricks, as I often refer to them as. So you can
absolutely, kind of I mean, steps. I feel that too. And it naturally happens, right? And that can naturally happen because we use versioning systems where you can, you know, rip out code and share it and compare it. This is one of the things I can very easily see happening in the future, is that like we are streamlining certain parts of the BO process. And that obviously works because it's modular. And you can just take one part and put it there and use it as a starting point, right? It's oftentimes just a starting point. And then every time the starting point gets a little bit better because someone makes an improvement and it gets established.
If one person updates that module in a central location, then all the different pipelines using it can all benefit.
Yeah. We, especially with our kind of like Botosh op app, we do have the idea that this could be a central place where everyone can use this kind of like framework easily and use it as a starting point. And then any changes made there, you know, translate to the rest of the community. Don't reinvent the wheel, you know, really don't reinvent the wheel in some regards there. And then for Meta and Studio, I mean, material science has some catching up to do. Bioinformatics is, you know, making great leaps. And so I'm hoping that we can, you know, make an impact in terms of sustainable materials, better concrete. You know, it's not going to completely remove the impact, but like, you know, a 1% improvement in solar cells translates to huge improvements worldwide, and 10% improvement in CO2 emission for concrete also has huge impact. So if we can utilize machine learning to make some contribution to that and do that in a smart and efficient way, because we're structured and we're sharing and we're building a community around it, then that makes sense to me as a thing to invest in.
Very cool. Inspiring.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to kind of working together, hopefully more in the future, and good luck with hiring those positions. Maybe we can post them in the jobs board on the Nextflow Slack.
They're already hired, but we do, of course, have future positions as well. So do check out our careers page on Meta on Studio. Yeah.
Yeah. And anyone interested, you can kind of Google, I'll put the links in the show notes as well, but there's the Meta on Studio website as well.
On there on the friend page, you can also see the tutorial. So, of course, check out the talk at the summit. But if you actually want to do that hands on, you can just do it and click through our platform. So our platform is, you know, super open in that regard. You can do everything I just said in the platform. Go through a tutorial, kind of develop your own material in a fun way.
Very cool.
Learn a bit about Facebook.
I'm going to go and have a play when we're finished here. And then your 2022 talk here, which is a great watch.
Yep.
Fantastic. I might just kind of wrap up with a couple of standing points. But we've just had the NF Core hackathon in March, so that was online. But we have more events coming up in the community. So we've got the Nextflow Summit in Boston in May. And then kind of looking further ahead, we've got more the Barcelona Summit in the autumn, and both of those have their own associated hackathons and more training and so on. So lots of stuff going on. Maybe Jacob, see if we can pull you to one of these events as well.
That'd be great.
And if anyone's interested in your hackathon, when did you say that was your...
Yeah, so unfortunately, probably by the time you hear this episode, it has been done. But at the end of March, it will be the Bayesian Optimization Hackathon. It's probably the first one in its world of that kind. So it should be Googleable. It will be promoted on our webpage as well. So you can go and check out the results of that once, you know, after this episode, and maybe see if someone used an Nextflow pipeline. We will definitely use an Nextflow pipeline.
Very cool. Cool. Well, yeah, looking forward to, hopefully we can all kind of learn from each other. Great stuff.
Absolutely.
Great. Jacob, thanks so much for your time. Thank you for joining me today. And it's been a pleasure. And yeah, maybe we could check in a year or two and see how things are getting on.
Definitely, yeah. Thanks for the time.
Great. Thanks very much. And thanks everyone for listening.
Bye. Thank you.